the maple buds turn red on the hillside, and the harvest trees are blooming.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This week we'll travel to the Feast of the Ramson in Richwood, West Virginia, where we'll meet 12-year-old ramp digger Tyler McCune.
You can dig a lot of ramps, but you can at least leave some roots behind, that way they'll grow. We'll be able to keep having this good ramp feed up here in Richwood. Everybody enjoys. I enjoy it.
And we'll head to the Shenandoah Valley to hear a crowd of sacred shape note singers.
It's a song that's full of fear about what it means to be human, to be alone in the wilderness of existence. But for me, there's something comforting about being a stranger among other strangers and making this sound together.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia.
When the maple buds turn red on the hillside, and the harvest trees are blooming in the lane, and the ramps begin to grow in the mountains, then you'll know that it's springtime again.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Here in Appalachia, it's ramp season, and that means many small towns have their annual ramp feed to help raise money for their communities. One town has been celebrating their devotion to this garlicky leek for 77 years, Richwood, West Virginia. Richwood once thrived on lumber and coal. As those industries fell on hard times, so did the town. Every spring, though, this struggling Appalachian community celebrates its abundance of wild ramps with an event that locals call the Feast of the Ramson. Now, for those of you who may have tried ramps at an upscale restaurant in Pittsburgh or New York City, this is a whole different shebang. Richwooders cook ramps the way lots of mountain folks have been eating ramps for generations, cooked in plenty of bacon grease. The event is held every year on the third Saturday in April. Although the Richwood High School mascot is still a lumberjack, the town boasts itself as being the ramp capital of the world. Last year, our producer Roxy Todd attended the ramp feed.
The air is saturated with the smell of ramps, a pungent, garlicky, peppery smell, so strong that it eclipses almost everything in the room. There's also an aroma of bacon. The ramps have been fried in bacon grease and are served with brown beans and ham. A local songwriter, John Wyatt, is playing his Richwood ramp song for the hundreds of people waiting in line for their meal.
And the ramps begin to grow in the mountains, then you'll know that it's springtime again.
Ramps are the first wild foods that appear in the forest each spring. The yearly tradition of eating ramps symbolizes the renewal, hope, and vigor of spring. The festival also marks a return for many Richwood natives. Dana Johnson moved to Alabama, but he comes home for the festival each spring to make sure he gets his dose of ramps.
They are considered a spring tonic. They're good for you.
Many people, like Johnson, have left Richwood to find jobs or open new businesses out of state. Since 1980, the town has lost more than 40% of its population. And a third of the remaining 2,000 or so residents are living in poverty. The ramp feed is one of the few moments in the year when this depressed small town feels like a thriving community. Out-of-towners also come to the festival, like Carrie Comiskey from East Hampton, Connecticut.
This is my first time tasting ramps and my first time to the Ramp Festival, and I plan to come back every year.
With her tanned face, Comiskey is in hiking boots as she sits with her husband and their two friends at a local restaurant. She lists the purchases that she's made at the festival: a handmade wooden table and a wooden coffee grinder. And fresh ramps, of course. She bought these from the Four Seasons Outfitter store, located along the two-lane highway into town. The owner, Bruce Donaldson, is also the largest ramp seller in Richwood. He ships about 20,000 pounds of ramps each year to buyers all over the U.S.
My men, the men that work for me, are basically laid off in the wintertime. A lot of them's in the logging industry. A lot of them transfers to coal fields, and they'll work a month. They'll be laid off. Sometimes they'll have to go 100 miles to find another job.
Like to buy some ramps?
People are camped out by the side of the road, hawking ramps that they've harvested. 11-year-old Tyler McCune is out with his stepfather and his uncles, selling the wild leeks for $4 a pound. He wears faded jeans and a navy blue t-shirt, and his blue eyes squint in the sun.
He taught me how to dig ramps, my uncle, he taught me, my grandpa, my stepdad.
Tyler's grandfather and stepdad used to work in the sawmills. His grandfather is now disabled, and his stepdad's out of work. But they still dig ramps each spring as a family. Some people here worry that ramps are being overharvested, and there's a debate over how much of a threat that is. Tyler McCune says his grandfather taught him how to harvest the right way, without being, as he calls it, an overpicker.
Overpickers? Yeah, they like dig every ramp they see. See, you can't do that here. I mean, you can dig a lot of ramps, but you can at least leave some roots behind. That way they'll grow. We'll be able to keep having this good ramp feed up here in Richwood. Everybody enjoys. I enjoy it.
At the end of the one-day festival, organizers estimate the crowds have consumed about 1,700 pounds of wild ramps. The local Chamber of Commerce has raised about $3,000 to $4,000. The money will help the city remove a few of the abandoned, derelict buildings and add more art and historic photos to the vacant storefronts in downtown Richwood. For NPR News, I'm Roxy Todd.
That story first aired last year on NPR's Morning Edition. This year, the Feast of Ramson takes place on Saturday, April 18th at Richwood High School. Tyler McCune says he'll be there again this year selling ramps. If you plan on digging ramps in the Appalachian Mountains, we'd love to see your harvest. You can show off your ramps over on our Twitter page at InAppalachia. If there's anything else that brings folks together besides food, it's music. Next, we head over to the Allegheny Mountains to a small church near Harrisburg in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. One Sunday morning in early June, radio producer Kelly Libby took a trip from her home in Charlottesville to the Cross Keys Ruritan Hall. She wanted to meet and hear the Shape Note singers who had come in from all over the country, just so they could sing together from a new songbook. Sometimes this style of singing is referred to as sacred harp, but as Kelly Libby explains, this shape note singing was different.
Like a lot of shape note sings, this one starts with folding chairs. And the way the chairs are set up is key. They're arranged in a square, all facing the middle. Each side of the square is for a different voice part. So there's treble, alto, tenor, and bass. Shape note singing is not a performance where the chairs face an audience. You're there to sing for each other. This is how every tune starts, with something called singing the notes, kind of like do, re, mi, except this one goes fa, sol, la, fa, sol, la, mi, fa. And because this is harmony, one voice part might be singing fa, while the others might be singing sol, or la, or mi. On the page, the notes take different shapes. Triangle, rectangle, circle, and diamond. The shapes tell you what note to sing. Sometimes this style of singing is referred to as sacred harp. That's because there's an old tune book called the Sacred Harp, and most shape note singers use it, especially in the Deep South. But today is the very first all-day sing where they're using a new book. It's called the Shenandoah Harmony, and it's bringing back some old tunes that aren't in print anymore, some of which came from right here in the Shenandoah Valley. This one is called Burn. Across the road from the Ruritan Hall is a cemetery, and during a break from singing, a big group of us walked over. I saw that somebody had put flowers on a grave. It was the grave of a man named Ananias Davison, who it turns out is part of why we're all here today.
Davison was a Scotsman. His family immigrated down the valley in the mid-1700s.
And that's John Del Rey. He's a longtime singer and singing organizer, and one of the people who helped compile the new Shenandoah Harmony book.
So there are a number of his tunes in this book?
There are, but, you know, for the most part, he was a compiler, an adapter, an arranger. And he was able to coordinate with other people. I like to think of myself as being able to do that, too. And he coordinated with people all down the Shenandoah Valley, all through Virginia, and all through the western Kentucky and Tennessee. And he gathered tunes. He was like a song catcher, in the early 1800s.
In early America, this was religious music. But people who do shape note singing these days come from all different backgrounds. Some are religious, and some are not. Some people come from just down the road, and some are here today from as far away as Chicago and Oregon. There are Mennonites in modest clothing, and then there are people wearing shorts and t-shirts with Birkenstocks. Sitting in the square of this shape note sing, I feel transported to the Shenandoah Valley of the 1800s. I picture harsh winters in a new world, and a long walk through dark woods to arrive in a place made of rough boards, a place that probably brought momentary peace and transcendence in what was likely a pretty rough frontier life. It's the harmonies, or the lyrics, or the sensation of the music passing through my body, or the sheer volume of all these voices colliding. Maybe it's the total effect, but when we get to this tune, I cry. The first verse goes, "I am a stranger here below, and what I am is hard to know. I am so vile, so prone to sin. I fear that I'm not born again." It's a song that's full of fear about what it means to be human, to be alone in the wilderness of existence. But for me, there's something comforting about being a stranger among other strangers and making this sound together. For the Authentic South podcast, I'm Kelly Libby.
That story originally aired on the Authentic South podcast last January. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. When we come back, we'll hear from a restaurant that uses politics as a main ingredient.
And the mountain winds blow. And the mountain winds blow. So as long as the earth turns, waters flow on, Appalachia will live in her music and song, and the mountain winds blow.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
We began this episode with a story about how one food, wild ramps, is literally helping one Appalachian community hold on to its roots. Now we head to a restaurant in Pittsburgh that uses food to create awareness and discussion about political issues. The restaurant is called Conflict Kitchen, and the chefs say they usually choose their evolving menu based on current events overseas. WESA reporter Bob Studebaker went to the Conflict Kitchen to find out what was on the menu and why they were serving it.
Can I ask you a little bit about the challenges and the rewards of being in a place where you get to immerse yourself in so many different culinary cultures?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really rewarding as a chef is to be able to have the time and the necessity to delve fully into a cuisine, to fully immerse yourself in one specific cuisine for the amount of time that it takes to develop, you know, a full menu of it, and to keep, while we're running the cuisine, to keep going back to it and finding new dishes so we can have, you know, our rotating specials and things like that. So really get to immerse yourself completely into each specific cuisine.
That's a conversation I had recently with Robert Sayre. We were in the kitchen of Conflict Kitchen, where he's the head chef. NPR once referred to Conflict Kitchen as an experimental public art project, and the medium is the sandwich wrap. This unique Pittsburgh venture is one of many innovative ideas realized with help from the Sprout Fund.
The Sprout Fund is a small nonprofit grant-making organization to support creative people and innovative ideas in Pittsburgh.
Ryan Kuhn is program officer for the Sprout Fund.
And we do that by providing small, what we call catalytic grants, basically grants that are just large enough to get an idea started, to test it out. Because there's a lot of people and small organizations in the Pittsburgh region that, you know, have great ideas. Maybe they're a little outside the box, or maybe they're a little non-traditional, and maybe are not a good opportunity for fundraising or getting a grant from a major foundation. But with just a little bit of support from Sprout, they can test out their idea and maybe see if it can prosper.
Not all of the Sprout Fund's grants go to artists or arts organizations, but some do.
You know, visual arts, performing arts, written and spoken word, cinema arts, and also theater along the way throughout the organization's history.
The Sprout Fund gets involved when the project fosters active community engagement.
As far as the projects that we've supported directly that are about using arts as a method for community engagement, a few stand out for sure. The Conflict Kitchen is one that Sprout was able to support with a seed award a few years back when it was first established in East Liberty. And the Conflict Kitchen's approach of creating a public space where people can do a very normal activity, like buying food, you know, going out to lunch, getting some street food, but interjecting into that cultural conversations around cultures and countries with which the United States is in political conflict.
That's an idea that'll only work if the food's good.
We come here regularly. It's on our regular lunch docket, and we like when the menu changes. So this is the last time we'll probably be here while there's still North Korea.
On the day I visited Conflict Kitchen, Vincent DeGeorge from Morgantown was enjoying lunch, and he remarked on how people can sometimes tune out news media accounts of important issues, and how he appreciates this non-traditional approach to foster awareness and spur conversation.
But if it's somewhere you go to lunch and it says, oh yeah, you know, we are in conflict with these countries right now, it reaches people who wouldn't otherwise be reached. I think it's fair to say a lot of America has maybe forgotten that we're still in Afghanistan. We would like to think that, you know, that's all over, but, you know, that's the menu they're switching to next month, and it reflects the reality that we are still there.
Co-directors John Rubin and Don Waleski schedule events, performances, and discussions that seek to expand public engagement with the culture, politics, and issues at stake within the focus country. It's takeout food where you take away more than just something to eat. For Art from the Ground Up, I'm Bob Studebaker, 90.5 WESA News.
That story first aired last March on WESA Radio in Pittsburgh. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Fried bread dates back to time, and it's so important. I put it in the rhymes as long as we wear our mocks and feathers. Keep the traditions of our ancestors.
Now for another tasty food with important significance for some communities, Native American fry bread. Karen Wood, the director of the Virginia Indian Program, says fry bread is a new traditional food. Lila Fucan of With Good Reason has the story.
Karen Wood is a poet and anthropologist. She's also a Monacan Indian, and she's agreed to give me a cooking lesson.
We're going to make fry bread, which is an a not-so-traditional Indian food.
We measure out the flour, salt, water.
And then you just start adding flour until it becomes workable.
Karen stretches and pats the dough into soft, round saucers. It's time to put the dough into the skillet.
And you flip them when they start to turn golden?
Yes. Okay, so that's done.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that people make at home a lot, or is it just a powwow food?
I would say in reservation communities, people make it at home all the time because there's still a lot of poverty. It's also something you would expect to be at every celebration.
The history of fry bread isn't a long one, but it's a painful one.
During the late 1800s, a lot of tribes were confined to reservations, and they were issued rations.
Sickness and starvation were devastating on the new reservations, but this is where the flour and lard rations were first turned into fry bread.
It's a very simple food made from a very desperate time.
You can top fry bread with just about anything, and Karen lays out the plan for the gravy we're going to make.
I'm going to make a little roux, and then we're going to get this jar of canned venison.
That's right, she said canned venison.
This is venison from a deer that was shot last year.
Now, Karen's a Monacan Indian, and sometimes she trades with a friend from the neighboring Chickahominy tribe. And this time, it was a home-baked cake for a large mason jar of tender meat. Karen gives the history of Monacan-Chickahominy relations in a nutshell.
So we used to be enemies back in the old days. We used to come down to the Chickahominy territory and raid their corn. We don't do that anymore. So we get along pretty well, but we still have to trade. That's how it works.
So now I'm going to take a bite and see how it turned out.
Wow. Oh, it's amazing. The fry bread is great, but the gravy's really what makes it.
Magical gravy.
Oh, my goodness.
Fry bread plays such an important role in Native American communities that there are legends, movies, and songs galore written about it. Today, I'll leave you with a little bit of a song by Blacktop Native. Fry bread dates back to time, and it's so important. I put it in the rhymes as long as we wear our moxie feathers. Keep the traditions of our ancestors. Can I have some fry bread, please, with a little bit of yeast? Heat up the grease, cause we gonna... I'm Lilia Fukin.
It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. Today we've got some help from John Wyatt, the musician you heard earlier in the show playing the Richwood Ramp song. John's going to tell us the story behind how one mountain in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, got its name. Here's a hint. The name comes from an early settler who is said to have spent a winter or two in a large, hollowed-out tree. So all you trivia heads out there, what was his name and what is his mountain called? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Hi, I'm Jessica Lilly, lifelong Southern West Virginian and host of Inside Appalachia. Every week, we search out stories that take you inside communities and introduce you to Appalachians with something to say. How many times have you heard a story here on Inside Appalachia that surprised you? Can you remember a time when you said, I had no idea that existed in Appalachia? One of our listeners recently tweeted that our show highlights stories that are under the radar. There are lots of stories still waiting to be told, whether it's the latest on current news in the region, the struggles of people in the coal fields to have clean drinking water, or the story of a community trying to create new jobs. We keep you connected to the struggles and victories of the people throughout Appalachia. But we can't tell these stories without you. If you like what you hear on Inside Appalachia, then I hope you might consider making a donation to West Virginia Public Broadcasting, wvpublic.org, and click the donate button. And from all of us here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thank you for helping us tell West Virginia's story. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. A native son of Big Sewell Mountain in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, songwriter John Wyatt joined us in the studio this week to help us learn about the story behind how Sewell Mountain got its name.
Sewell Mountain, what is it? It's a mountain. It was named after Samuel Sewell, who was he and Jacob Marlin came across the mountains into what's now West Virginia, and for a period of time they lived in Marlinton, named after Jacob Marlin, and somewhere along the way they got in an argument or a dispute over, from what I can research or read about, over some religious something about religion, you know, and they split up, you know, and they Samuel Sewell came over to Sewell Mountain. And, you know, that's never happened, that people would fight over religion. That's never happened in the world, you know. But they did, and he came to Sewell Mountain.
Well, if you spend enough time in a tree with somebody, you got to find something to dispute about.
Exactly. And, you know, that I was just going to mention that. I know they say that Samuel Sewell lived in a tree. Now, if you're in Marlinton, they'll say that he lived in a tree up next to Marlinton. If you're in Sewell Mountain area or Rainell or in that area, they'll say that he lived in a tree in the Rainell area. So maybe he just moved from one tree to the other. I'm not sure, but he did. But if you think about how huge those trees were back then, George Washington in his journal measured a sycamore tree that was 48 feet in circumference as he traveled across the Midland Trail going from, you know, from Rainell and into Charleston. And 48 feet in circumference, that would be a 12-foot tree. I mean, if it was hollow, it depends on how hollow it was, that would be a pretty good size place to lay down and sleep and keep your goods at, I guess, you know. Because back then, people didn't build very big houses anyways, you know. They were small compared to what we have today.
Almost hobbit-like.
Yeah, almost. But I don't know. He came there, and the mountain was named after him, Big Sewell Mountain and Little Sewell Mountain.
I was born on a farm on Big Sewell Mountain, and I lived with my daddy when I was 16. Then I got the urge to go over the mountain, see all the good life I'd never seen.
John Wyatt says he wrote that song when he was in his 20s after he decided to make his way back home to Sewell Mountain. Many of you might know all too well the special homesickness that calls many Appalachians back to their mountains. Yet today, the number of folks leaving for the cities is growing. West Virginia is losing population faster than any other state, with about 3,300 total residents lost from July 2013 to July 2014. That translates to about 0.2% total population loss in just 1 year. From 2010 to 2014, 39 of the state's counties lost residents, while 16 showed an increase. Southern West Virginia, the coalfields, continued to see sharp population decline, while the Eastern Panhandle and Monongalia County have seen a boom in recent years. John Wyatt says he remembers that he wanted to leave Appalachia when he was 18. He says the feeling to leave West Virginia started when he was 12, when John F. Kennedy was campaigning in West Virginia. John heard a news anchor use a word he'd never heard before. The word was poverty.
They said the poor, poverty-stricken youth of Appalachia, with no hope for the present and no hope for the future. And when I heard that, something clicked in my brain. It just floored me. I remember asking my dad, I didn't know what poverty meant. I knew what the word poor was, but I was 12 years old. I had no idea really, you know, what poverty really meant. And I remember asking my dad, and dad, he may have known or he may have not have known, but he told me to look up the word the next day when I went to school. So the next day when I went to school, I got the dictionary and I read what poverty meant. And man, that just, it did something to my psyche, to me as a 12-year-old boy in Appalachia. And I realized that I was lacking in something that, you know, the rest of the young people in the rest of the country, you know, they had. So from that time, from the time I was 12 years old until I graduated from high school, that's all I wanted to do was get away from Appalachia, get away from the farm, get away from rural America and go to the city and be like all the other urban people and have opportunity and have everything that supposedly was there and wasn't here. When I was a sophomore in high school, that summer, I went to Philadelphia and worked that summer. My cousins worked building construction trade, and so I worked with them. My junior year in high school, I went to D.C. and worked in the Woodbridge area and did the same kind of work, and just in construction work, you know. And then I joined the Army and spent 3 years in the Army. During Vietnam, I didn't go to Vietnam. I was in Europe most of the time. But I kept searching for whatever it was that we didn't have in Appalachia. I kept looking for it. And I just couldn't find whatever it was that I was looking for. When I was about 23, I was sitting in a little apartment on the west side of Cleveland, and I thought to myself, whatever it was that was supposed to be here in the city or out here somewhere in this big wide world, it can't compare to what was back there in West Virginia, in Appalachia.
Walking down a dirt road on my way back home, looking for a place I can call my own. Spent too many years trying to find my way.
John Wyatt came home to West Virginia in the 70s, but he said that the economy in Appalachia today makes the decision even more difficult for young people trying to come back home to West Virginia. It's nearly impossible to find well-paying jobs or, in some places, any jobs at all.
For folks coming back or staying in Appalachia now or in West Virginia, it's tough. But things are changing, and some of them are for the good. I mean, right now, with the economy and the way, I mean, people are leaving in droves, leaving West Virginia. And a lot of the people who are coming back are the ones like myself now who retired, who went to Detroit and worked in the car, you know, the automobile industry, and some who went to Cleveland or D.C. or wherever, and they're moving back. They've retired and they've bought the old home place and they've come back. And places in Appalachia, you can go and you can find people just like they were when I was growing up, and they're real. And you know, first time you meet them, they'll come up and they'll still pinch my cheek, you know, even though I'm 67 years old. Some old granny woman will come up and pinch my cheek and say, "Oh, honey," you know, and like they used to when I was a kid. It's a great place to live, great place to be a part of.
Wyatt also says when he was growing up, his family was very poor. They worked the land for most of their food, and John's father worked odd jobs in the coal mines and the lumber mills. John said his father also earned some extra income from moonshining.
I remember when I was a boy, my dad and some of the other men would always go groundhog hunting, but they would never let me go with them. You know, I was 6-7 years old, and I thought, well, why don't they let me go groundhog hunting with them? And they would always go down the holler, and then when they would come back hours later, they would be kind of wobbly on their feet. And I finally realized that they weren't going groundhog hunting at all. There was something else down the holler there that folks here in the mountains have been a part of through the years.
Speaking of shine, well, the kind sold legally, we have an update on a distillery in West Virginia. After almost 2 months since closing its doors, the Bloomery Sweet Shine Distillery in Jefferson County reopened this weekend after a successful cry for help to West Virginia lawmakers. Liz McCormick reports.
It's been almost 2 months since this popular tourist spot in the Eastern Panhandle has had people and laughter within its walls. During this year's legislative session, the Bloomery Sweetshine Distillery closed after years of being classified as a retail liquor store. The distillery owners claimed this as a misclassification and said it was costing them too much money, killing their business. The distillery closed in early February, and the owners said they wouldn't reopen until the issue was addressed by lawmakers.
It was an overwhelming heartache. It was so drastic for us to make that decision.
That's Linda Losey. She's co-founder and one of three co-owners of Bloomery Sweetshine.
You know, we've been funding the distillery for 3 years out of pocket in trying to get to profitability, and it was really affecting our relationships, our hearts to keep opening and losing and losing and losing, because we absolutely, absolutely love what we do and what we do for this community and for our fans and how they react to us. So for us to make the decision to close, we had to make it for the financial reasons, but it really was a drastic decision. And to put 17 people out of work, that's what was the killer for us.
The Bloomery Sweetshine owners estimate it has attracted more than 50,000 tourists to West Virginia since it opened in 2011, some of which were from outside the U.S. All of its liqueurs are made on site and by hand, and most of the fruits and nuts used in the drinks are grown on site or are sourced within the local community. The distillery offers tastings and the option of buying their products on the premises. Rob Losey is co-owner and in charge of sales and marketing. He says the decision to close the distillery surprised their local legislators.
I think that it was also, it was received well by every one of our legislators, and that trying to figure out a way to help us. And really to help our county. I mean, one of the things that we do is we bring in a number of tourists. And, you know, we're, you know, someplace that people from out of state find as a destination. So they come to visit us, and then they spend other time in the county and leave some tax revenue behind. And I think that was recognized, and that we were, a bit of a shining star in our area. And it was something not to be lost.
In light of the news of the distillery's closing, legislators began putting together a bill that would help Bloomery Sweetshine and other distilleries and mini distilleries like it. Senate Bill 574 was the answer. The bill will reclassify distilleries in the state and give some tax and management fee relief to those owners. It would also raise the production level allowed for mini distilleries. Governor Tomlin signed Senate Bill 574 on March 31st, and it will go into effect on June 12th. The owners of Bloomery Sweetshine Distillery were elated by the news, but Tom Kiefer, co-founder and co-owner, says their closing was not a ruse.
We didn't close the doors to send a message that was unintended. We closed the doors because we couldn't afford to stay open. So I don't agree that a business should close down just to make a stand and fight for reduced taxes. I mean, for us, it was, as Linda had said earlier, a do-or-die situation. And the fact that we were dying on the vine because we always had to supplement every month the business that occurred in the tasting room just was not an affordable way to continue on.
Linda says it was ultimately the response from their fans that drove the message home to legislators.
One of the strengths that we had behind us was our fan base. And so if a small business is absolutely feeling the pinch of government regulations and it's killing the business, then I don't disagree that you have to somehow contact the legislators and get help, because it's nearly impossible to do it without the legislative action that is required to put laws into effect that will help the small businesses.
During Bloomery Sweetshine Distillery's reopening Saturday, it offered tastings to more than 350, most of which visited the distillery for the first time. The owners say they are satisfied with the response from lawmakers and are excited for the effect of Senate Bill 574 in June. Next year, the owners plan to push lawmakers for another bill, one that will allow them to sell their products on Sundays. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Charlestown.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from With Good Reason and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, WESA, the Authentic South Podcast, the Allegheny Front, and State Impact Pennsylvania. We want to give a special shout out this week to WMOV, our new affiliate station in Ravenswood, West Virginia. Music in today's show was provided by John Wyatt and Ben Townsend. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album, Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.